Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Happy Halloween, everyone. In part one of today's program, we're going to be talking about a program by the Bell Ensemble of Racine, a presentation of a very rarely heard and quite dramatic work called Totentanz, Dance of Death by Hugo Distler. In part two of today's program, you'll hear from the co-authors of a very interesting book called Go to Hell, A Heated History of the Underworld. To get us into the mood for part one of today's program, here is a little bit of Franz Liszt's work known as Totentanz, or Dance of Death. Well, now that we have you thoroughly frightened by Franz Liszt's Totentanz, or a little bit of it, we welcome into our studios the founder and artistic director of Racine's Bell Ensemble, Nick Berudian, who has joined us on a couple of previous occasions to talk about some of the performances of the Bell Ensemble, which is just in the second year of its existence, but already the Bell Ensemble has presented some very, very intriguing works and some uncommonly heard repertoire. Nick Berudian, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. It's great to be here.
You are early into this second season of the Bell Ensemble. For anybody who's not heard any of our previous conversations, explain what your group is all about and the ways in which it functions maybe a bit unconventionally.
I tend to explain the Bell Ensemble as a collective of singers. I serve as the director and coordinator of the programs that we put on, and those programs involve anywhere from two or three people in a joint recital type situation to a small chamber choir like we have for this performance of Distler's Totentanz. We have nine singers in our chamber choir, and I'm directing.
So kind of explain how this shifting cast tends to take shape. I suspect it's kind of a combination of factors that determine who sings when and what on what performances.
Sure, of course, there are everybody's individual schedules. But also, of course, for each program, I attempt at my best to put the right voices in place. For our first performance this year, just a couple weeks ago, we performed a Taste of Oktoberfest at Uncorked, the wine shop in downtown Racine, and had four of us in quartet, and had the good fortune of having Melissa Cardamone at the piano, who also is a fine soprano, in her own right. And so we had a fifth singer to trade off every once in a while. And that was a real nice blending of voices. In this program with the Totentanz, we have singers who are more regularly with us. We attempt to draw from as local a pool as possible, but for the Totentanz, for example, we have singers coming from north side of Chicago and Milwaukee and helping to fill out our ranks in a way that I'm very pleased with. I think is going to produce a really nice sound for our ensemble.
One of the things that the Bell Ensemble is already known for is some of the uncommon repertoire that you managed to uncover. Just talk for a moment about your interest in and sort of appetite for rarely heard repertoire, and maybe talk a little bit about the process of just coming across such repertoire. I mean, do you make a concerted effort to seek things out that are hardly ever heard or very little is known about?
I do. It comes partly naturally. I act upon my own interests and however quirky they may be and try to make them palatable for general consumption. I also think it serves a place. You know, we have a lot of fine music in our area, and it doesn't make sense to me for this group anyway to repeat a lot of the most common works or the great works that we already have at our leisure. So partly it's a way that I think we fill a niche here. In last year, in our opening season, that also allowed the sort of peculiarity of our selections allowed us to serve Racine in a pretty specific way. We had two concerts, one dedicated towards Danish Baroque music and celebrating producing a Christmas festival at a Danish church in Racine, and we also had a concert commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Armenian Genocide, which we participated with the Armenian community in Racine and putting that on, and that was a really special way of being a part of the community.
Hmm. So this concert that is coming up this weekend is of a very rarely heard work by a composer not well known to the general public, although I happen to know the name Hugo Distler because the Nordic Choir with which I sang in college sang one of his Christmas motets. So I know the name Hugo Distler, and it makes me excited for this work that you are about to present. Say a quick word to our listeners, first of all, about the composer, and then about this piece in particular and how you even came across it.
Hugo Distler's always been a really fascinating figure for me. I learned about him when I sang this this piece or selections of the Totentanz at Luther Seminary. And it was part of my sacred music studies there. That was in celebration of what would have been his 100th birthday in 2008. And Hugo Distler was a Lutheran German church composer in Germany in that first part of the 20th century, and became very, very quickly a leader in the sort of reform and re-enlivening of church music. Of course, there was an entire nationalistic awakening in Germany in the first part of the 20th century, which led to all of the tragic events of World War II. And Distler got caught up in that. He was so gifted that he rose very quickly to a place, to a state-sponsored professorship in Berlin, and was more or less forced to join the Nazi Party, and he committed suicide.
Hmm.
There was no note. It wasn't exactly clear, but it's basically presumed that he couldn't bear the thought of serving in any way the purposes of the Nazi Party.
Right. Mr. Noble, Weston Noble, who conducted Nordic Choir for so many years, when he would introduce the piece that we sang and would talk about Hugo Distler, I remember he would always use the phrase, but he could not stand man's inhumanity to man, and took his own life, which is, we can surmise, was at the heart of why he did that. So you have before sung this Totentanz. Describe kind of its dimensions.
The Totentanz of Hugo Distler is a self-described choral motet. It is constructed in 14 rather short movements, and each of these movements is an address to a person being called to dance with death. The Totentanz, or the Dance of Death, is a sort of literary genre of the medieval period, and the text, both of the choral portions of the Totentanz and some dramatic insertions have both been drawn from sources of the Middle Ages. And so Distler's work here, the Totentanz, is set up as a 14-movement motet, and between each movement we have a new character, a new person coming to meet death personified.
Wow.
And we see what that interaction is like for each one of them in a different way, and then the choir basically represents the heavenly choir, the voices from beyond calling them.
Well, in a moment, we're going to meet your stage director, Marine Kashin-Bolag, but first, let's hear a little bit of music from Totentanz. Tell us about Movement 4.
Movement 4 is directed to Movement 4 is directed to the Edelmann, which I've seen translated various ways, governor, or sort of... public servant, a public leader, not a king, but a servant of the Commonwealth in some way. So someone with a significant power, and Movement 4 calls him to. It beckons gently but somewhat urgently to do away with all evil.
Wow! So here's just a brief snippet of Hugo Distler's Totentanz.
Dein jäh Erscheinen friert mir das Mark in den Gebeinen. Mussten Könige, Fürsten, Herren sich vor mir neigen und mich ehren, dass ich nun soll ohn Gnade werden, gleich wie du.
Die fiel nur der Welt.
That's really beautiful music by Hugo Distler. Again, a brief movement from his work called Totentanz, which is being performed this weekend by the Racine Bell Ensemble. Nick Berudian is the founder and artistic director of the group, and the stage director for this performance is someone many of you will know if you attend frequently the Lakeside Players at the Rhodey Opera House here in Kenosha, Maureen Cashin Bolog, who has joined us. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Nick, say a word about the way in which you conceived this work, the kind of performance you wanted it to be.
Well, you usually, it's not like you see this performed every day, but when this is performed, it's typically staged in really the most simple of ways. And the dialogues that take place between choral movements usually consist of one person standing next to another and basically a staged reading of that dialogue. And I was looking for something more than that. And I was led to Maureen by one of our singers, Amy Boudersee, that has that's friends and has worked with Maureen before. And so Maureen and I sat down and I could tell at our very first meeting there were good things happening because she was blowing my mind with staging possibilities and added characters and all kinds of really interesting ways of using the script that we have from Johann Klocking, which is the author of the dialogues.
Hmm. So, Maureen, tell us more about how you sort of took this work and, in a sense, kind of ran with it a bit.
We find inspiration from all sorts of people in our life. And when I work with Amy with our Singing for the Actor program, so that's how I know Amy. She works with me at Actors Craft. And I teach acting. So as it just so happened, in my class right before I met with Nick, the class I had two dancers, Marissa Watson and Autumn Gapko. And Autumn Gapko had done a performance during the course of our class, a take on something she did with Renaissance Fair for, you know, with these kind of spirits of Hades, the spirits of the underworld. And she had the whole outfit on. And it was when she did a transformation in our class from street clothes into that outfit, she changed the energy in the room. And it was so powerful to see that. And so now we have the Dance of Death. And Marissa Watson is she was a dance major. She was also in that same class, and she's a trained ballerina and liturgical dance. And I had seen footage of her. So it's called the Dance of Death. So I thought, wow, well, what if we have these dancers who lead the souls to death? And Marissa Watson has choreographed some beautiful, beautiful work, and she dances the life of the character. So when death calls, and death is played by Cameron Spencer, who has been on the radio shows here. Mm-hmm. He's got this velvet, rich, fantastic voice, you know. And so death calls the next soul. And then Marissa Watson, as the dancer of death, she dances their life. Every dance is different. And then she leads them to death. And we have, Autumn playing the spirit of Hades, the underworld spirit, and then we have Sydney Untermeyer, and she is the heavenly spirit. So those few souls that get to heaven, Sydney would be leading them. And then we've got a cast of 12 different actors who play the various souls, and they are from different periods in history. So we've got like a 12th century hermit, and we've got a 1960s party girl, and we got a 1940s sailor, and a noble woman with gorgeous Renaissance fair type outfits, and we just it's beautiful. So I'm so excited when I've been working on this, just to sit and watch it happen, and to be even in the course of the rehearsal process, to feel my soul uplifted watching this beautiful dance, hearing this incredible music. It's just been really a privilege, and it's really been humbling to be a part of something that's so beautifully written and has brought so beautifully to life.
Mm-hmm. So the script is in English?
The entire thing is in German. The script has been translated into English by Carthage professor Greg Baer.
Wow.
And we're using that translation for the actors. So our audience will have no trouble understanding the movement of and the narrative of the piece. Our singers are singing in German. I considered using a translation created by a group of professors at Luther Seminary, in English translation, and I just felt like with the music, too much is lost by having to shift around words and change rhythms, and so we're using that. But this is another interesting element that Maureen has added that she hasn't mentioned yet. You won't actually have any trouble understanding what the choir is singing either, even though we're in German, because we have a narrator who is serving to sort of link together verbally the different movements, the different characters that come. And so as Death calls the old man to come to the dance, the narrator speaks then on behalf of the heavenly choir to the old man and gives the text that we will be singing.
So immediately ahead of hearing each movement.
Yes.
Wow, interesting. Here's another movement. This is movement 7, which is for the nobleman. Anything you want to say before we hear this music?
I think jump right in.
Okay, here we go. This is another excerpt from Hugo Distler's Totentanz, or Dance of Death. Boy, this is bringing back happy memories for me of singing the music of Hugo Distler. He writes so beautifully for the voice. And Nick, I imagine that your singers have really enjoyed the pleasure of singing this music.
I think so. I hope so. I always I fear a little bit throwing my peculiar tastes in front of other people and forcing them to work on it. But nobody has complained too much, and I've even seen quite a few smiles.
Right. So for such a complex kind of performance, it must take a lot of time, I should think, although I suspect time is a luxury you don't have in the abundance you wish. How much time has there been to put this together, in a sense, theatrically, dramatically, especially within the space of the sanctuary at Holy Communion where this performance will take place?
We have our first of two combined all company rehearsals tonight, and well, backing up, Maureen and I started talking. It was
my building was not complete. I'm building a theater, and I didn't get. So it was probably in the spring. We must have spoke.
Yeah, we had auditions in August for both actors and singers, and Maureen has actually had the more complicated schedule to figure out because of all of these different actors who are each on one at a time. So
there's 29 people between Nick and I, the choir, the musicians, the singers, the actors. There's 29 people involved in this production. So 12 souls, 3 dancers, Death. So we started rehearsal in September, and I was able to work around actor schedules on, so just like twice a week for since September, and then every actor just kind of met on the half hour, and then in the last couple of weeks, we've been putting everybody together. So,
wow. So you have yet to see this as a totality, in a sense. I mean, you have yet to see all of this unfold.
Correct.
Yes.
As
conceived. There's work to be done still.
I've been using the, something on YouTube, and so I've been using the music from a German group on YouTube for Marissa to dance to while we wait to get together. So, yes, so it's been...
Wow.
We're excited because I saw Bell Ensemble last week at the Uncorked event, and they were so fantastic. And I'm just even more excited about having all the singers together. It's just going to be so beautiful.
Wow. Nick, say a word about the space in which this is being performed. Was this a very specific choice you made to do this at Holy Communion?
Holy Communion was one place that I had at the top of my list. They were the first that I asked, and I was really pleased that we were able to make it happen there. It's a large, I think it's usually referred to as neo-Gothic. I don't know architecture, but it's a large, tall sanctuary space, and it has fantastic acoustics for singing, especially singing like this, which is composed of just a few parts and. Kind of intricate and clean sounding lines. We're also performing at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in Kenosha, and it's a similarly welcoming space for this kind of music.
So when exactly are the performances then?
November 4th and 5th. November 4th at 7:30, we perform at Holy Communion Lutheran Church in Racine. And November 5th, also at 7:30, that's a Saturday, we're at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in Kenosha.
Right. And so you'll get to have dress rehearsals in both of those spaces, I assume, or hope?
Yes. Yep. That was a necessity.
Yes. Tonight is at Holy Communion, and Thursday's going to be at St. Matthew's.
Wow. Nick, it must be one of these kind of pinch-me moments to actually see this long-held hope coming true, that you get to actually share this rarely heard work with the community.
It's wonderful. Yeah, I never imagined it would come to fruition in this full a fashion too. And I'm so grateful to Maureen for all of her work with the actors and all of the ideas we've shared putting this together and all of her input in the production.
Right. So this might be just the first of numerous collaborations.
I hope so.
Right. So, well, we are certainly excited about the rare opportunity to encounter this work. So tickets are available at the door. Do people need to be doing anything ahead of time?
Admission is free.
Ah.
This is largely due to a grant from ArtSeed, or an ArtSeed grant from the Racine Arts Council, and the generosity of the Osborne and Skekic Family Foundation. And so we're very grateful for them for making it possible for us to provide this for free. A free will donation will be gathered at the door, and we don't begrudge those in any way, but you don't need a dime to come.
Wow. So Totentanz by German composer Hugo Dissler in a performance that involves choral singing and dance and theatrical narration, all wed together beautifully by stage director Maureen Cashin-Bolog. And at the helm of it all, the founder and artistic director of Bell Ensemble. To finish out this portion of the morning show, we're going to hear one more excerpt from Hugo Dissler's Totentanz, or Dance of Death.
This movement is one of the last movements. It's the second to last movement. The only one that follows is the concluding word from the heavenly chorus. And this is an address to the little child that is called by death and speaks on behalf of the whole group in a way about the relative injustice that death can bring.
And with that, we will finish out this first portion of the morning show today. My thanks to you, Nick Berutian, and Maureen Cashin-Bolog for joining me today for this portion of the morning show. And best wishes with your performances this weekend with the Bell Ensemble of Distler's Toten Tanz.
Thank you for having us.
And on this Halloween, it seems appropriate to step from the Toten Tanz, the Dance of Death, to a conversation about hell. From the Morning Show archives, you're about to hear my conversation with Kira Thompson, a Emmy-nominated documentarian, and freelance writer Chuck Cristofoli, talking about a fascinating book which they wrote a number of years ago called Go to Hell, A Heated History of the Underworld, in which they examine the very concept of hell as it has appeared in cultures all around the world and throughout human history. This fascinating book is published by Simon. I'm especially fascinated by sort of the tone of this book and the fact that, I mean, it is just loaded with fascinating information, and you have obviously done a whole lot of research, and yet this is not a scholarly tome. You've adopted a little bit of a light touch, and yet not too much so. I mean, it's a very intriguing balance which you have achieved here. Tell us a little bit about what I presume was a conscious choice which you made.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the main thing we wrestled with, because we weren't approaching this as academics or theologians. And on the one hand, we wanted to respect the history of this place and respect the very serious beliefs around it. But on the other hand, even, you know, in the course of our research, it was interesting to find that the place had this split history, where on the one hand it's always been a place that's feared, but it's also been this inspiration for everything from lowbrow comedy to the highest art in those mystery plays that Kira mentioned. They would fairly reverently act out some of the Bible stories and scenes from the Bible, but when it got to a scene set in hell, that was sort of the break. That was the comic relief. You know, that was almost like a slapstick scene. So we were looking for a tone that could kind of work both ways, and sometimes it felt like a fine line to walk, but we were happy with the way it all came together.
A very interesting observation is made in the introduction of the book on which draws a contrast between heaven and hell, and the way in which each of those places have been talked about or described through time, and not just within one tradition like the Christian tradition or the Jewish tradition, but even across cultures, that in terms of specificity, there is a real difference between heaven and hell. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, yeah, just that there, we talk about how, you know, it almost perhaps would seem presumptive of us, you know, mere mortals, to imagine the details of what heaven would be like. I mean, we all hope we're going there, but it seems a bit presumptuous to imagine that we know just exactly what it's going to be, and it's treated with, you know, obviously been treated with great reverence, whereas with hell, again, it's back to this, it is absolutely feared, has always been feared, but there's always been a fascination with it as well, and so through a lot of what we have, our sort of common knowledge about hell isn't always necessarily directly from the various religious texts of the day, but from a lot of the writings outside of the church and so forth that have described what goes on in hell in often great detail. If you look at writers like Dante and many others, you know, there's, you know, Dante wrote about not only, you know, what goes on at each given of the nine levels of hell, but also, you know, in fact, how the sewage system worked. I mean, it's just incredible detail there. So
in other words, we really don't see comparable works about heaven. No one is describing or attempting to describe heaven in that kind of detail.
Well, you know, in the case of Dante, I mean, he actually gave us it's a three-part work that takes us from hell to purgatory to heaven. But in a lot of cases, it seems like you just, you know, there's just this. If you've got a setting where you've got wicked souls who have been prone to committing wicked acts, you've got a better, in some ways, a better engine for storytelling. You know, a better setting for stories that are going to grab the imagination, and that's something that seems to cut through in all sorts of religions and all different cultures. There's a lot more active goings on in the underworld.
We're speaking with Chuck Crisafulli and Kira Thompson about the book they co-wrote called "Go to Hell: A Heated History of the Underworld." That subtitle reminds me of something pointed out, I think, in the first chapter of the book, namely that when we go to some of the most ancient writings about what we think of now as hell, that some of the earliest writings and accounts and stories don't really describe it as eternal damnation, but simply the underworld where dead souls wandered. That's an interesting distinction.
Yes, I know it is. It's interesting to see how it developed. I mean, you're right. Nearly all cultures did have some sort of underworld where, you know, souls passed after they died, but they weren't places of punishment. If you look back at, you know, for example, to the Babylonian times, there were, you know, again, an underworld, but it was this is where everyone went after they died. The idea of it was a land of the dead, really. And it wasn't really until later we look at, for example, the Egyptians, where the idea of punishment and judgment came along. And, for example, with the Egyptians, they one's heart would be weighed against a feather. And if it was as light as a feather, one passed to the field of rushes. But if one's heart was heavier than a feather, it meant it was laden with sin, and one's heart was immediately eaten by this vicious monster, Amut, who was the eater of the dead. And so that was one of the first examples of this idea of judgment and punishment coming in.
As opposed to what you describe as a neutral underworld.
Correct.
Which is how it was often described before that. I was especially interested when you were talking about the ancient Egyptians and something which they constructed called the Book of the Dead, which described the underworld, first of all. And you talk about how this Book of the Dead was actually written for the dead. I mean, for the sake of the dead, to be helpful to the dead when they were dead and gone and in this underworld. Tell us a little more about how exactly that worked.
Yeah, I mean, what gets referred to as the Egyptian Book of the Dead really came from writings on the inside of pyramids. There's parts called the pyramid text and also coffin text, things that were actually carved on the insides of and outsides of coffins, basically giving the departed soul a roadmap, you know, how to find your way to the underworld, how to find your way through it, and especially how to avoid some of the perils, how to get past the particularly fearsome crocodiles that were there, and these flesh-eating beetles, and evil spirits that would like nothing more than to curse a soul into an eternal state of confusion. so it was sort of the map quest for the departed soul, how to find yourself, how to get yourself to through the underworld and with some luck to the field of rushes.
So the dead would have these hieroglyphics to read and these images to look at, and it would serve as a guide for them.
Yeah, and they actually had a concept of there was a two-part, the soul was actually, there were two parts to consider. They wanted to preserve the physical body, which has given, you know, gave rise to the whole concept of mummification, that there had to be this physical shell preserved, but that wasn't the part taking the journey. There was a spirit portion of the soul that would actually descend to the underworld.
You explore, of course, all kinds of different cultures and traditions, and we find some fascinating things here. For instance, there is also a Book of the Dead for the Tibetans, and a very different sort of scenario painted involving, if I remember correctly, 49 days.
Yeah, and that was it's an interesting contrast, because it's a very similar process, except in that case, the soul is sort of automatically in a state of confusion, and it's up to the loved ones the soul is leaving behind to guide the soul through these various prayers. That's what's in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, that these prayers that you would offer to the soul, almost like a the hometown cheering section, leading that soul past its similar torments and a very past its similar underworld that a soul could easily get lost in. So in that case, the book is written for the living.
Hmm. Actually, that's an interesting case too, because obviously there comes in the idea of cultures and religions that believed in reincarnation as well. And so for the Tibetans, hell was, the actual hell lasted a very specific amount of time. It was 49 days, but it was an extremely unpleasant 49 days before one was given the chance to come back and take another chance at living a good life.
You know, it's interesting as we read about some of the images that have been created or conceived. It's amazing the kind of awful, frightening things which get imagined or painted for us. For instance, a concept I wasn't really aware of at all, that of the hell mouth. Mm-hmm. Describe to our listeners what this is and just how frightening this is.
Yeah, the roots of it trace back to that ancient Egyptian underworld, where if your heart outweighed the feather of truth, you were gobbled up by this monster. And there's this idea of hell not as a sort of passive location that you enter, but as something very much alive that can gobble you up in paintings, medieval Renaissance paintings. You see the development of this idea where there'd be you can see the Satan sitting on his throne, and beneath the throne will be these jaws that are there to gobble up the souls. And in some of these mystery plays, and even in some of the puppet parades in the Middle Ages, the hell mouth was a crucial piece of scenery. If they had it up on stage, it was sort of this giant demon mouth that would be set over a trap door, so you could actually see a soul descend. Even in these puppet parades that they would have, the most fearsome character in the parade would be this mouth that's coming after any wayward souls. we looked a little at the history and then thought it was interesting that this idea very much stayed alive even in something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where she was in a town set over a hellmouth, this very very forbidding gateway to hell that's ready to gobble up souls.
As you quite rightly point out, your book is not only about these fearsome images of hell, but it's also a book about the way in which at least some human beings seem to take a sort of delight, relish the prospect of sort of tiptoeing around the jaws of hell, as it were, and a playful sense of daring, which has at least been the attitude of some. Talk for a moment, for instance, about something so intriguing called hell houses. This is something I had no acquaintance with whatsoever, but reading about them in your book makes me want to know more.
Yeah, this was an idea that is credited originally that there was something that happened at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University around Halloween called a scare mare, and a pastor in Colorado, Assemblies of God pastor, in the early 90s began putting together these presentations of it's really an alternative to the idea of the Halloween haunted house, where you would walk through and see just all sorts of terrifying images. In this case, it becomes a hell house where it's the same concept. You're walking through, seeing these tableaus and scenarios and different kinds of frightening characters, but they're all representative of what you might encounter in hell, with a particular emphasis on how what particular sins are going to send you there. You're watching you see a drunk driver who's killed his family in an accident, and there he is suffering the eternal torments for his mistake and various sins and the punishment that will be meted out to them. As far as we can tell, these are still being put on and still still a pretty popular draw as an alternative to the classic haunted house.
Chuck Christofoli and Kira Thompson, they are the co-authors of this very intriguing book called Go to Hell, A Heated History of the Underworld, published by Simon. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Tomorrow on the morning show,